Listen now to the Gospel of Jesus Christ according to Luke. Now about 8 days after these sayings, Jesus took with him Peter, John, and James and went up the mountain to pray. And while he was praying, the appearance of his face changed and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly they saw two men, Moses and Elijah, talking to him. They appeared in glory and were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and his companions were weighed down with sleep, but since they had stayed awake, they saw his glory in the two men who stood with him. Just as they were leaving him, Peter said to Jesus, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah," not knowing what he'd said. While he was saying this, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were terrified as they entered the cloud. Then from the cloud said a voice, "This is my son, my chosen, listen to him." When the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone, and they kept silent, and in those days told no one of any of the things that they had seen. On the next day, when they'd come down from the mountain, a great crowd met him. Just then, a man from the crowd shouted, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son. He is my only child." Suddenly, a spirit seizes him, and all at once he shrieks. It convulses him until he foams at the mouth. It mauls him and will scarcely leave him. "I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." Jesus answered, "You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." While he was coming, the demon dashed him to the ground in convulsions. But Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And all were astounded at the greatness of God, while everyone was amazed at all that he was doing. This is the good news. Ten years ago this week, I checked a big item off my bucket list when I toured the Sistine Chapel on Ash Wednesday. It was a place I'd always wanted to see, but I have to be honest with you, my visit ended up being a bit of a mixed bag. On the one hand, the building and the artwork were spectacular. That Michelangelo guy could really paint. On the other hand, as religious experiences go, this one was kind of frustrating. See, I'd expected to enter this awe-inspiring room, steeped in respectful silence, and behold one of those rare spaces, one of those thin places, where the divine and the human intersect. Just as everything in the chapel seems to emanate from that single spot on that famous painting up on the ceiling, the one where God and Adam reach out to one another and join hands. I thought that I, too, might have a reality-changing moment gazing up at that place. But what I encountered was nothing like that at all. Forget about solitude. There must have been 1,000 people crammed into that chapel, which incidentally is a lot smaller than it looks on TV. And the crowd was neither quiet nor respectful. It gets so noisy in there, in fact, that the Vatican employs a group of professional shushers, whose sole job responsibility, so far as I could tell, was to tell people to pipe down when they got too loud. I'm not kidding. I don't enjoy being in large crowds one bit, and I was incredibly disappointed that this occasion I'd looked forward to for so long was turning out like this. So I made my way over to a bench on the side wall and sat down to sulk for a little while. The scene I saw from that vantage point is one I will never forget. Here were all of these people in this majestic church staring at the ceiling, completely oblivious to everything that was happening around them. They were talking too loudly. They were setting off camera flashes in other people's faces. crashing into each other as they moved around as if they were inside a giant pinball machine. What struck me about this whole experience was the singular focus that people seemed to have with what was going on up there. A fixation that led them to disregard everything that was going on down here. It was as though something had been lost in that 70-foot span between the ceiling and the floor. Luke describes something similar in today's gospel passage, which, of course, is his account of the transfiguration of Jesus. Jesus took with him Peter, John, and James and went up on a mountain to pray, is how it begins. Now, if you don't know this story or didn't know this story at all but had read the Old Testament, the mere mention of a journey to a mountaintop should have made you stand up and take notice, because some pretty important and wild stuff happens on mountains in the Hebrew Scriptures. Just ask Moses and Elijah. They'll be along in a minute. And the religious significance of mountains is definitely not just a Judeo-Christian thing. Their stability and power on the one hand, and their proximity to the sky, the place where since ancient times the divine has been thought to reside in many faith traditions, on the other, have made mountains important places for the world's religions since the very beginning. Listen, for example, to the words of Allah in this excerpt from the 95th chapter of the Quran. "By the fig and the olive, by Mount Sinai, and by this land made safe, truly we created man in the finest stature. Then we cast him to the lowest of the low, save those who believe and perform righteous deeds, for theirs shall be a reward unceasing." The reference to Mount Sinai is clear enough, but the symbolism of classical Arabic, the fig is understood to be the mountain upon which Damascus was built. The olive is the mountain upon which Jerusalem was built. And this land made safe is Mecca, elevation 900 feet, which doesn't really sound too great to us here, but that's pretty high for that part of the world. These are, of course, three of Islam's holiest sites. We humans, regardless of our religion, tend to aspire to be higher because we believe that we can find God up there. The minarets, the steeples, and the pyramids of the world seem to be evidence of this basic idea. We are focused on getting up there from way down here in the lowest of the low. And this makes sense, because down here feels especially low this week. Can you imagine what the people of Ukraine would give to live in a land made safe? Lest we tarry down here too long, let's return to the action on Mount Transfiguration. Don't worry, we'll be back down here again shortly. As soon as our weary travelers arrive on the mountain, things really get weird. Luke tells us that while Jesus was praying, the appearance of his face changed and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly, they saw two men, Moses and Elijah, talking to him. They appeared in glory. If all this weren't actually enough to convince Peter, James, and John that this was no ordinary day and that Jesus was no ordinary guy, God decides to show up in a cloud and make this very clear. Luke tells us that from the cloud came a voice that said, "This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him." And then just like that, it's over. Right after God finishes speaking, Moses and Elijah are gone, and the special effects are gone too. Peter, James, and John find only Jesus there alone. The stunned disciples are left speechless. They head back down the mountain with Jesus, telling no one about all they had experienced up there. Our story takes an abrupt turn, though, that doesn't seem to have anything to do with what just happened up there on the mountain. Back down on low ground, people have gathered around Jesus once again, seeking healing. A desperate man in the crowd shouts out to him, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son. He is my only child. The child is seized by a spirit that leads him to shriek, to convulse, and to foam at the mouth. His father has already asked, actually begged, the disciples to cast out this demon, but they couldn't seem to do it, or didn't want to. Jesus becomes quite exasperated, mostly at his disciples, I think. He lashes out in frustration, "You faithless and perverse generation, how much longer must I be with you and bear with you?" Jesus calls out to the man, telling him to bring his son over after the unclean spirit makes one last stand, throwing the boy to the ground in a fit of convulsions. Jesus heals him and gives him back to his father. Luke closes the scene by telling us all we're astounded by the greatness of God. Now, I'll be the first one to admit that I never understood why these two stories are paired together. The adventure on the mountain on the one hand and the healing of the boy with the demon on the other. They don't seem to be related in any obvious way. But have a look at the point where they come together. Consider the last words that are spoken in the first story and the first ones that are spoken in the second. And then think about who actually says them. "This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him," says God to Peter, James, and John way up there on the mountain. "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son. He is my only child," says the desperate father to Jesus back down on flat ground, because the disciples he begged to do so were unable or perhaps unwilling to help. It seems that the disciples are so focused on what's just happened up there with God, they fail to pay attention to what's happening down here with God. Ironically, though, they don't seem to have listened very well to what God told them either, because if they had been paying attention to Jesus, as God commanded them to do, they would have remembered seeing him heal all sorts of people, including society's outcasts. They would have remembered seeing him feed the hungry. They would have remembered seeing him forgive the sinful. They would have remembered seeing him dine with tax collectors. They would have remembered seeing him show concern for all people. And they would have remembered to do likewise. But they didn't do likewise, and that's why Jesus becomes irate here. When are they going to get it? When are we going to get it? God isn't only in the bright lights and booming voices up on mountaintops. We don't experience God simply by gazing upward at the ceiling. We truly encounter God when we take the inspiration that is found on high and bring it to bear down here among the lowest of the low. Because God is to be found in both places. God is to be found in all places. God chooses to reveal God's self to us in bits and pieces and all sorts of different people and places and faiths so that we can, hopefully, come to understand the essence of God just a little bit better. Sometimes that happens in really spectacular ways in places both natural and man-made that leave us awestruck and in miracles that testify to God's majesty and mystery. But sometimes it happens in other ways too, including, but certainly not limited to, the life of a poor Jewish carpenter from the wrong side of town who came preaching love and justice for all. Or through the words of the prophet Muhammad, peace be unto him, who instructed Abu Zar to not look up to those who are above him, but to look instead to those who are beneath him. Because maybe, just maybe, we actually catch a glimpse of God looking back at us in the face of every single person we encounter down here, not just the people we know or like or understand or agree with or who can do things for us, but everyone. What if those people, the invisible people, the unlikable people, the poor people, the people who really need us, What if those people are angels of the Lord? This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him, says God from the clouds. I beg you to look at my son. He is my only child, says the man on the street. Do you have any food for my son? Asks the mother whose sleeping child is lying on a subway station floor in Kyiv. He was our only son, cries the father of a young soldier from St. Petersburg who's just received that dreaded knock on the door. How are you going to respond the next time